So here we are at the end of the module. Did anybody attend the Decolonize the University discussion last week? Okay, so because it did occur to me that in some sense, what's one of the agendas of this week's reading might be called unthinking Eurocentrism, or the question of how to unthink Eurocentrism, because it seems to me this is actually much more difficult an idea than you might otherwise have thought, simply because it isn't as though the concepts for the concepts that you could do a decolonized a social science or a decolonized philosophy simply exist. I'm thinking, for instance, of V.Y. Mudimbe, the African philosopher, who goes so far as to say that in some sense, that Africa doesn't exist in social scientific discourse. That what there is, of course, is what has been conceptualized as Africa. How do those categories, or how do the concepts used, tribe, for instance, or the larger concepts, nation, and so on, how do they relate to the actualities of life as lived by Africans themselves? How does one decolonize anthropology or decolonize literature itself? You find this problem being raised across the globe. I'm thinking also of Abdelkibir Khatibi's work on decolonizing Arab sociology, for instance, where Khatibi argues that it's extraordinarily difficult to do this. If we start with the idea of Eurocentrism, very simply, I've just taken this off the off the web. It's off a Latin American site, and it's in Latin America that the ideas or one important strain of what is called decolonial thought is raised powerfully. Actually, my own sense is that this that the idea of decoloniality, as it's raised in the Latin American context, is quite problematic for reasons that I'll try to suggest a little bit today. But here you see the sense that at the heart of Eurocentrism lies this binary way of thinking. So the particular sense of the argument is that within there is a stable identity or a stable body of knowledge, and that body of knowledge is either just mapped onto other people or else cited as a gap. So most prominently, the concepts of modernity, progress, and universal history have been identified as inherently, quote, European in their provenance. The standard account, and certainly this is true, for instance, if you looked at Kant, as we did very briefly, or if you look at Hegel, so all the way through the mid-19th century and into the 20th, I would say, modernity painted in terms of a self-contained European process of moral and economic progress. Of course, the moment you start looking at the terms being activated in this formulation, you begin to see some of the problems. There's the idea of globalization, for instance. Is globalization, what exactly is globalization? Is it simply the universalization of the West? Is it westernization? Or is it what you could then call coca colonization, for instance, or McDonaldization, as these things have been called? The idea of a singular cultural logic being being sort of imposed or mapped onto the rest of the world. One standard definition of cosmopolitanism seems to work with that. If cosmopolitanism is the American who treads softly and carries a big stick, for instance, we understand that cosmopolitan figure who feels at home in the world, that world is made in the image of the United States. But the moment one says something like this, we realize that that also the relationship between Europe and the West has to be thought about. If we speak of Eurocentrism, we could also speak of Western centrism, for instance. But think about those two concepts, if you like, of Europe and the West, because they don't have the same meaning and they don't have the same history. They thread together at various moments. But two classic statements of the problem around Europe and the West can be thought of. Firstly, if you take the standpoint of mainstream American philosophy often views itself as in some ways the outgrowth and the legacy. In other words, it takes up the legacy of Europe. That as it were, as the spirit of Europe powers onwards, America arises as the idea of Europe squared in some way. And then we often find that Americans castigate what they then call old Europe in some way for being stuck in the opposition. That if Europe is the spirit of modernity and progress, the West as represented by America kind of takes it over and often finds Europe wanting. On the other hand, think about the extraordinary Slavophile debate in Russia in the late 19th century, where where a group of Christian conservatives argued that they needed to save Europe from the West, as they called it, that Europe was westernizing as they saw it. And it needed to reassert its Christian conventions, its Christian origins, that they saw the West as the enemy and Europe as what they were fighting for. So you see that these terms are not always together with one another. Modernity also, what's the relationship of modernity to the West or to Europe for that matter? We haven't spent very much time in the module talking about secularization, but that's an important part of the story also. So just to throw all of the terms in some way into the hopper at one time, how do capitalism, democracy, freedom, science, reason, how do they play into these debates for us? What about what you might regard as the dark side of them? Colonialism, terrorism, domination. Are we talking about perpetual peace, as Kant evoked, or perpetual war, which is what we seem to have ended up with? If you think about that idea of the West and how it's understood, sometimes caricatured in the rather nice slogan, from Plato to NATO. Which is, I've always thought is quite a nice formula. In his commentary on the West in Keywords, Raymond Williams outlines a history of fairly radical discontinuity, not of continuity. He says that the earliest European form of the West, of course, every culture knows a West, so we have to say European form, because anywhere then, if you're there in KwaZulu, for instance, in 1750, there's a West. It's just that it isn't associated with this concept that we're talking about. The Chinese very particularly have a notion of the West, well before there's a Europe that is the name of that West. So the earliest use that Williams finds comes from the division of the Roman Empire from the 3rd century, and then it's followed by the division of the Christian churches, the Great Schism, from the 11th century. And then both meanings, the Roman and the Christian, are then superseded by contrast between the West as a Christian civilization
and then an East, which is variously defined as China or the Islamic world, particularly. And after 1945, of course, with the advent of the Cold War, a further refunctioning gives the binary opposition between West and East a new geopolitical significance. There's the evident political divisions between Western and Eastern Europe, and then that was soon generalized to what was offered as a universal contrast, free world, for instance, versus the therefore presumably unfree world. In common sense language, as Stuart Hall points out, the West characteristic designates not only or even primarily a geographical zone. I mean, it's an interesting term, West, because it's a geographical marker, isn't it? You say West referring to a point on a compass. But that isn't what we mean when we speak of West. How does that geographical term become a civilizational one? Western civilization, it's an odd notion. So it's a type of society, says Hall, or a level of development. And he points out that the term is almost identical to the word modern. So across the whole range of scholarship, it seems to me, we find a tendency to situate the global dispersal of capitalist modernity in terms of the universalization of the West. So it's as though, in some ways, if we're thinking about how the world becomes capitalized. If we think of commodity production and wage labor as dispersing, very often that's understood in the literature, or that is to say, the scholarship, as something about westernization. But is it? Should we be thinking of capitalism in terms of the West? We can't think it except through the dominance of the West, but is capitalism to be understood as somehow modally or normally or paradigmatically Western? And it would seem to me that's where the difficulty comes up, particularly because as people think about that movement of capitalism, they tend to think of it not as a movement of a mode of production imposed on wage labor, for instance. They think of it in terms of civilization. A kind of cultural disposition. So, and let me refer you briefly to two influential works which are about the rise of the West or the challenges that are supposedly facing the West. And both of these works are taken from the far right of the American political spectrum. And in that sense, that kind of, you might accuse me of finding fairly easy targets to look at, but they're different from one another in what they suggest, and they're both quite influential or important. The one is Samuel Huntington's The Clash of Civilizations and the Remaking of World Order, and the second one that came out at the end of the 90s, and the other is Theodore von Laue's The World Revolution of Westernization, as he called it. This is how his book, this is von Laue's book, this is how it begins. Within a brief time, essentially within half a century, people were thrust into a common harness by a small minority commonly called the West, the peoples of Western Europe and their descendants in North America. You automatically you see there, don't you, the way in which West and America, or Europe and America are brought together in this concept of the West. The human condition in the present and the future can only be understood within the framework of the westernized world. So westernized stands in here for another concept. You might say capitalized world. This is how many would understand. But he doesn't say that. He says westernized. So the West is the agent of change here, or more particularly Western people in some sense. So when he talks about the conquest of the rest of the world, he still works with these notions. The massive confluence of the world's peoples, started by irresistible force, by guns, supported by a vast and complex array of cultural skills and so on, an overwhelming political presence that excelled also in the arts of peace. The moment I read that, I think, my goodness, it's an extraordinary way, isn't it, of defining the last 500 years. Cultural skills excelled in the arts of peace. Somebody should have told some of the American presidents. It's an astonishing formulation to me, anyway. Let's focus on the assumptions that underpin what he's saying here. I want to emphasize two of those assumptions. First, there's the supposition that the making of the modern world is to be accounted a discrete and autonomous achievement of the Western minority who profited most by it. That is to say that the modern world is made by Westerners, he suggests. And we see immediately here the one of the problems coming from it. And then there's the supposition that the making of the modern world drew upon civilizational attributes that were possessed by the people of the Western Europe and their descendants. And both of those assumptions obviously have been falsified by scholarship over the last 50, 40 years or something like this. But what makes von Laue's argument relevant, I think, is the fact that he neglects altogether the socio-material basis upon which the modern world is predicated. There's nothing here about the organization of production in this argument. So this is idealist historiography of a conservative kind. If you contrast what he writes there with Marx and Engels, for instance, in the Communist Manifesto, I think the oppositions become very, very clear. He continues. The Europeans, he says, exploited the world's resources, which were hitherto mostly dormant. That, of course, is another astonishing claim. Native Americans didn't obviously know anything about the land that they live on. The idea of kind of a just people were almost like squatting on the land, and it took Western scientists to know, and so on. Sprang from Europe, from the hothouse competition among the Europeans themselves, they foisted their singular qualities on the unwilling and unprepared majority, dynamically transforming the entire world in their own image, establishing a hierarchy of prestige defined by the success of imitation. So the argument is that Westernization is the cultural dominant at the world level, not capitalism. He doesn't speak about a mode of production. The entire world in their own image. How do we understand that? Do we think, for instance, that the Indian bourgeoisie today, for instance, or the Egyptian upper classes are in some sense are fundamentally mimicking the Western elites, which is what he seems to be suggesting. So nothing that's said here is not also featured in Marx and Engels' description of the coming of the epoch of the bourgeoisie. They speak of the exploitation of resources, imposition of the market, competition between capitals, generation of historically unprecedented social wealth, enrichment of a few, immiseration of most, universal interdependence of nations, they say. Interestingly enough, they also talk of the battering down of all Chinese walls. We'll come to those questions in a minute, and so on. The categorical difference between them and von Laue, though, is that Marx and Engels talk about the capitalist mode of production, the bourgeoisie as a class. They don't speak about the West and Westerners as a population or the agents. In Huntington's case, I think it's the same and different. Huntington speaks of the world order again as being governed by westernization, but he argues that the world is that there's a resistance to this, and that the world is multipolar, and that the West should rein in. It should protect itself, but it should not attempt to universalize. That's Huntington's. If you look at the way Huntington writes, Western civilization emerges in the 8th and 9th century, developed in its distinctive characteristics. It didn't begin to modernize until the 17th and 18th. The West was the West long before it was modern, he says. Again, let me just point out how fantastically unstable and unhistorical this argument is. So the things which distinguish it from other civilizations. So we've got the West emerging in the 8th and 9th. So by the 12th and by the 13th century, the West ought to have been around. Think about this, the 12th and the 13th century. Think of the relationship, for instance, between Northern Europeans, Norwegians, Swedes on the one hand, and Italians on the other. Think of Greeks, for instance. Where is Bulgaria, Albania, Russia in this notion of the West? Is there a West? Is there a West which is in some sense itself and cut off from other people? And the Mediterranean is a tiny, tiny sea. So is there not more contact, more movement across the Mediterranean than there is between, let's say, Greece on the one hand, or Italy, certainly, and Sweden or Scotland? Where does this idea of the West as one thing, what is it that Westerners understand? You can't speak in the 17th century of Christianity unproblematically because of the schisms. In fact, already by the 11th and 12th centuries, you can't speak of Christianity because of the break between the Orthodox, the Eastern churches, and the Western churches. So there's an extraordinary set of assertions coming into this. Here's Arif Derlich's critique of Huntington, which is worth focusing on. He proposes a fortress Euro-America to defend Western civilization against the intrusion of unassimilable others, and so on. Let me just sum up then by focusing here, this is Samer Amin in his great book, Eurocentrism, talking about what Eurocentric consciousness involves. Things which I think we take for granted. So if we're arguing that in some ways our task is to unthink Eurocentrism, the historical record shows, though, that this is not so easy to do. I'm only going to just draw your attention to one particular work here, but it's an important one. It's from 1975, a Nigerian writer called Chinwezu, who wrote a brilliantly titled book called The West and the Rest of Us. What you'll see is that Chinwezu doesn't challenge the ways in which the West is represented in the Eurocentric scholarship. He merely changes the values of them. Where von Laue speaks about skilled in the arts of peace, Chinwezu says warlords. He simply changes the values. So here is how his book opens. For nearly six centuries now, Western Europe and its diaspora, meaning America, and others, Australians, South Africans, etc., have been disturbing the peace of the world. So again, you have simply a counter-assertion. And the point that I want to make is that this kind of counter-assertion can't be the way in which we unthink Eurocentrism. You don't say Native Americans good, white settlers bad, in response to the Eurocentric argument, white settlers progressive, historically, the force with them, Native Americans in the way old-fashioned have to go. That isn't the way in which you can unthink Eurocentrism. What he does here, of course, is to tie one of the so-called Western inventions that von Laue is so excited by to their origins. So we see the Chinese firecrackers, Arabs, Chinese, and so on. So they've sallied forth from their Western European homelands to explore, assault, occupy, loot, etc. Look what happens when Chen Weizhu comes to talk about capitalism, and you'll begin to see some of the problems here. Her demands upon the resources of the world increased tremendously, and so on. And you'll see that in this passage, so Europe is dematerialized through personification. It's gendered female, it's racially coded as white, it's de-differentiated and then re-differentiated on the axis of class, so the divisions within are flattened out entirely and they make their appearance as a Manichaean divide between West and rest. I think this point needs to be emphasized, that what happens when you think in this way is that you construct the West as not only a racially and culturally homogeneous unity, but you flatten out the divisions. I mean, it's very difficult to talk, for instance, about gender politics in those terms, and it's almost impossible to raise the question of class. Where is class in the discussion of colonialism, for instance? And then so you get this idea of, you know, instead of class, there is only whiteness which dominates. And that becomes a great deal of difficulty. So imperialist predation is driven by the personality of the West. The West is understood as having an identity. The West exists in some ways to set out and conquer. I'm thinking of a great novel by the Ghanaian writer that I wrote my PhD on, Ikwe Armah, where he invents an American character who he names Amy in one of his third novel, which is called Why Are We So Blessed? It's called. And Amy, A-I-M-E-E, is he says she can scarcely to dominate is to breathe for her, is the way in which he describes it. Again, West is gendered female. And viewed as being essentially aggressive. This is no way I'm suggesting to unthink Eurocentrism. So it's in this context, perhaps, that we turn to Wang Hui. But just before we do, here's a characteristically brilliant moment from Piers Morgan. It's just so unspeakable. It exists on the same level. With the greatest respect to China, you know when somebody says with the greatest respect, I don't think they have quite our musical back catalogue as a nation. You've got to say, don't you realise the stupidity? China doesn't have the back catalogue of the West. You must be right. And this means that they don't have a particular history of popular music, which may be true, but they may not be so sad about that. Quite extraordinary. He's saying, of course, that the 2012 Olympic ceremony was much nicer than the Beijing one because we have better pop music, I guess. Anyway, so we turn to Wang Hui, and I realize that there's a tremendous amount here that is probably difficult or let's say even almost impossible for you. He's starting out then with this opposition between Tianli and Gongli. The problem is that he's saying that you can't simply count these two concepts as tradition and modernity. Because if you say Gongli refers to the modern, are you saying it's Western? Tianli certainly seems to be Chinese. That is to say, it is traditional, but what he wants to suggest is that If you think in terms of Tian Li epistemology, if you think of the world from the standpoint, so it's heavenly principles. The world is given to us by heaven. In the Chinese context, of course, this is not, this is imperial, because of course this is an imperial social order. And what he wants to describe, above all, is he wants to talk about the difficulties of talking about the change that comes over Chinese epistemology, theories of knowledge and of knowledge production in China, as you move from Tianli to Gongli. Because this isn't simply an abandonment of the Chinese and an embrace of the Western. On the contrary, much more seems to be going on than that. But he's suggesting in some way that you can't understand Tianli if you're asking yourself, if you stand within the philosophy of history, for instance. If you approach it, let's say, as a Marxist, as a materialist, what sense can you make of Tianli? And he's saying that in some ways that the way in which we construct the object of knowledge, if the way in which we construct the object of knowledge is already caught up in a particular epistemology, then all we can do is to confirm that epistemology in what we say of it, in the process distorting what we're trying to capture, he suggests. And he gives us these ideas. He shows us, for instance, that that for the range of thinkers that he's focusing on, Descartes, Galileo, Diderot, Bentham, Kant, they all developed this idea that they couldn't see beyond the West. But from his perspective, this is not something that's that can be taken on. As he says here, if there's one thread running through the rise of modern Chinese thought, it's the interaction between knowledge and system. That's the key point, I think, that he's trying to that knowledge is not simply the elaboration of concepts. It's also a reflection on the whole conceptual apparatus itself. Modern nationalism, so Tianli arises, of course, there's the local bureaucracy. Gongli always involves modern nationalism and also its related systems, including, for instance, the whole discourse of scientificity in China. And then this very difficult sentence, if there's one sentence that epitomizes my method, I strove to liberate the object of my study from its position as an object and to make it bolster my reflections and exploration. So what's the object of his study? The object is the origins of modern, the rise of modern Chinese thought. So let's say we take modern Chinese thought as the object of his study. He's saying that we have to liberate that as an object and to make it bolster my reflections and exploration. So that you have to, in some ways, make the historical transition itself do the thinking. And that becomes extraordinarily difficult. It means that you end up not only understanding change, but also deconstructing or disturbing the very idea of modernity itself. That's what tends to happen, he suggests. In research, the object of study is a structured point of view which I employ to investigate our limitations. We're back to that idea of our limitations, and we saw that for Kant it meant one set of things. For Foucault, it always meant something else. It was for Foucault, always you arise at that point of the limitations are the point exactly where you begin your inquiry. You want to push beyond those limitations. For Foucault, that's what enlightenment meant. And I think very similarly here for Wang Hui, except that for Wang, the question is always, what are the conditions of possibility? What historical situations, what systems have to be in place for this kind of thought to occur? How do you move from Tianli to Gongli? It isn't a matter of Western imposition. That doesn't happen. How do orders break down? What's involved in those kinds of questions? There are a variety of histories that you could insert here. This is a dynastic timetable, obviously, of China going way back, and that one is less important, I suppose, to us than this one, particularly from the Song onwards. And we're talking specifically about the movement within Ming, 1368 to 1644, Qing, which is the 1644, which brings us up to the Republic. In 1911, then of course the People's Republic, Mao's system, 1949 onwards. So if we're talking about the long period from, let's say, 960 to 1960, it's 1,000 years of history. And within that period, it's particularly within this formation, within the Qing dynasty, that this movement, this shift occurs. And he focuses very particularly on the May 4th movement. May the 4th, 1919, for a variety of reasons, which all speak to think of what's involved in May the 4th. So a group of students and members of women's organizations rally on the steps in Tiananmen Square. What they're talking about is the fact that the Treaty of Versailles, a number of Chinese territories have been ceded to the Japanese following the end of the First World War. And the Chinese are arguing, this is a nationalism that's coming up here. The Chinese are beginning to suggest that, you know, by what rights does Europe assign those territories which are ours to Japan? Japan had been very active as an imperialist force. It had fought a war against Russia. It had fought skirmishes and minor wars and then big wars against China at this time. They're also very particularly concerned with the rights of women, something which is not finding an echo, obviously, in any of the discussions. The suffragette movement, yes, but something else is taking place in China. They're also talking about a politicization of the class fraction of intellectuals, students and intellectuals, where they're saying, the word they're using is modernize. How do we modernize Chinese society? And there's a tremendous debate here. Does that mean, for instance, embracing Mr. Science, as he's called? Or does it mean embracing Mr. Democracy? What exactly is going to be learned from the West? What's going to be taken from within? Is Tianli a way of thinking through these problems? Isn't Tianli what has created China's weakness? Isn't it better, rather, to set up a new conception, a Gongli conception, a new idea, a new forms of bureaucracy, modern but specifically Chinese, defined by nationalism as distinct from the older concept of empire, which is a Chinese concept for them. There is a term empire, there are two terms, as we'll see, for empire. So tremendous kind of ferment, a thinking with and against Western conceptions. How does science, reason, progress, women's rights, etc., how do they take shape in 1919 in China? And we understand that these debates are powered by a discussion or a consideration of what's happening elsewhere in the world, but by no means an uncritical embrace of these things. There are all sorts of positions advocated, obviously. Some people are saying that the society should be westernized. Others are saying it should be re-traditionalized. But in the middle are these tremendously important intellectuals who are arguing for a specific kind of new formation, and they're the ones who are remembered. Here's the May 4th, 1919 memorial, which is in Beijing, still obviously a a contemporary one. I mean, it's less impressive when you drive past it. It's just cast aside. And I was struck when I went to visit it how few Chinese people were there compared to, say, the number of students at around Tiananmen Square, for instance. It's difficult to get to, also, you've got to cross all these roads, so it's sort of more of... I was struck when I went to Barbados last term by the fact that this wonderful anti-slavery memorial in the centre of Bridgetown is almost inaccessible, because it's in the middle of a roundabout. Why should designers build places like this in the middle of these huge roads? What Wang Hui suggests is that he thinks about the two variants of history that might be undertaken, and the first one is what I suppose we would call idealist history, and that works with the idea of if you think of, for instance, Confucianism. If we say that if we think of Tianli as Confucianism in some ways, we understand that a Chinese cultural expression and some way. And he says there are two difficulties with this. One is that it still uses Western philosophies, categories, and concepts to understand Chinese structures of thought. So in the comparative structure itself, there's a distortion of Chinese thought. Even if you're using notions like Confucianism, for instance, these are already defined, he suggests, by their opposition to a notion of Western rationalism, for instance. And they therefore already bear the marks of a Eurocentric historical epistemology. That you would have to think ancient Chinese culture in terms of ancient Chinese categories even while you estrange them. That's what's called for. The second problem, he says, is that the moment that you use an idea of Confucianism, you're not any longer very sensitive to historical change, to discontinuity. As I started by saying, this happens also in the idea of the West for us. We speak of Plato to NATO, and that emphasizes the unrolling or the unfolding of a single, something that we have in common, an identity, where there is no identity. And I think the same thing on the Confucian side. We have to think about radical change. On the social historical side, on the other hand, if we move away from idealist historiography to what Benjamin has in mind, a more materialist historiography, he suggests there are still problems there. The one is that we can't provide a genuine depiction of the significance of the social change or evolution itself. History often comes up to this problem of how do you describe change except in terms of what comes afterwards. We always tend to say, it's one of the effects of historical reason, is that we tend to argue that what happened had to have happened. The fact that it happened, what is the sense of necessity in the fact that, when you start thinking about this, you begin to sound quite ridiculous after a while, but because obviously what happened had to have been able to happen, or else it couldn't have happened. Things that couldn't have happened couldn't have happened. See what I mean? But on the other hand, the one thing that does happen was never the only thing that could have happened. So we tend to think from the other side of the divide. So think of the stock market crash. I think that's an example we've used in class before. It's impossible to do the history of the 1920s except with the stock market crash at the end of the 1920s as an organizing frame. But for those people living in the 1920s who didn't see it coming, it wasn't coming. So their lives were lived without any knowledge of what we have. How do we do the history from the inside? How can we create the culture of the 1920s without the stock market crash? And it's almost impossible for us to do this because we know what was going to happen. But we have to do a history that is open to the possibilities of what didn't happen, but could have happened. And the second problem, of course, is the second problem he suggests of the materialist line, or the social historical line, is that it tends to be too deterministic. It tends, he says, to collapse thought into the structures that underlie it. So you tend to say, he says, the relation between thought and society, it's easy to lapse into a determinist structure in which the function of ideas as a constructive power is overlooked. How do you give attention to the dynamic potentiality of ideas themselves in a materialist framework? And so these are the two problems. He obviously sides with the social historical method. He has no time really for the idealist one. You never find him talking of these concepts. But he's trying always to say, he gives us the description of Tianli society and says that we have to inhabit that world in narrating Tianli social existence, or else we can't understand it. If we think, if we begin by thinking, for instance, of how difficult it is to use the idea of heavenly principles, think of how, as a historian, you would approach the idea of the world is organized in terms of heavenly principles. If you're a secular historian, that's always going to be a problem. It's almost as though you're saying, okay, I'm going to tell you how it was organized, but I'm going to put a clothes peg to my nose. I'm going to sort of suspend the disbelief. You know, it's nonsense, but I'm going to tell you what it was like anyway. And so in other words, a certain kind of distortion always enters into things here. He's not saying, I think, that one has to have Chinese, because among the things, what would that be? Would it be to speak the relationship between Mandarin, for instance, and Fukien, Hokkien, Cantonese, most notably, the idea of Han. Is China the place of Han people? How do we deal with the ethnic minorities in China? These are all questions that he tries to raise. China has just the same tendency to homogenize. As we find in the West, and the historian of China has to hold that at bay. So if we go back to here he is talking about the, in early Confucianism, economics, military education, and so on, were all considered as organic components of rites and music. I mean, it's almost absurd to say it in those ways, but he's suggesting that it's only in those terms that you can understand Tianli culture. Even if, as a historian, you want to estrange it, because what he's really interested in is the relationship between thought and the enabling political social structuration of thought. He wants to talk about the relationship between concepts, if you like, and conceptuality. So it isn't just about the concepts you develop. It's about the structure of thinking itself. And how do you describe the structure of thinking itself? So I'm not saying we should abandon the discussion of social history or veer sharply off into purely idealist historical method, etc. And again, he comes up with this thing. It's to demand that we liberate our research object from the status of object, which would enable a methodological vision that allows us to investigate ourselves and our times and provide a new angle on conditions of knowledge. I find it's an explosive idea, but it's very difficult to get hold of. In some ways, when we're looking at Tianli society, or alternatively, when we're looking at Chaucer's world, we have to inhabit it, we have to liberate it from the status of an object. Our description is what we're interested in is not the world that Chaucer lived in. Because when we put it in those terms, we're already using modern epistemological categories. And it isn't as though we can abandon those, but we need somehow to suspend them. When we liberate the object, can we still really describe so-called modernity? So, because what you're describing is not something that comes from outside. How is modernity to be understood? Is the question here. Not to fix the significance of modernity temporarily, but to undermine the self-description of this modernity, to inspire our thinking on the rise of Chinese modern thought as such. He's suggesting that any thinking about modernity has to end up problematizing it and problematizing itself. Because what you realize is that in each particular place, modernity is so complexly involved in local conditions that there isn't a kind of a global template. There is no such thing as the worldwide revolution of westernization. That's not what modernity is. Modernity is the way in which local conditions, local situations are lived, are experienced, are thought through, are thought about. That's what modernity is, subject to certain conditions, under certain regimes, political, but above all political economic for him. But what does it mean, for instance, to the question of modernity, that there is capitalism in India or in China? You can't read from capitalism to the experience of modernity. You have to do this locally. You have to, I don't mean, you know, in a village or something. You have to do it in terms of the particular structure of conceptuality. That doesn't mean adopting the structure of that conceptuality, but it means certainly not thinking of this as an object that you can work through. So this seems to me to be fantastically difficult to think through, but also very, very important, both for thinking about culturally different formations, but for our own as well. If we critique Eurocentrism properly, we end up by destabilizing the givenness of the West as much as, of course, the givenness of the East. I hope that makes some sense. Anyway, I'll see you tomorrow and we can discuss it further.